G'day, it's Phil Edwards, Vision CEO here, with a quick invitation to become part of this amazing beacon of hope called Vision. Together we can put our love into action to help people of all kinds build or rebuild their lives on the truth of God. Please consider the part you can play during our upcoming Visionathon appeal, remembering that it's your support that makes Vision possible, including this podcast.
Audio on demand from Vision Christian Media.
And so here we are together, and we are contemplating how the cross impacts every facet of life. And this weekend, we're going to talk about how it impacts something that's very crucial.
Today
with Jeff Vines, pastor, apologist, and Bible teacher.
On this episode of Today with Jeff Vines, we have another message from the series called The Cross Before Me. If you miss any, you can find all messages in this series wherever you listen to podcasts. Here's Pastor Jeff to begin today's message.
So glad that you're with us. And I think how appropriate it is that our theme is the cross before me. Never in our lives does that matter more than when we're facing something that we don't quite understand. And this is a great time to remember the hope that we have within us. The Apostle Paul talks about that we mourn, but we don't mourn as those who have no hope. And so we are saddened by crises that happen in our world. But remember, the primary message of the cross is twofold. One, that even we're in the middle of the most difficult part of our lives, God can do his best work. The example, again, is the death of Jesus on the cross. And second, that there is a power that is associated with that, that God enables us to see things that we ordinarily cannot see unless something happens around our lives and our everyday living that kind of starts to disassemble any worldview that we have that will not maintain its integrity under the scrutiny of real life. And so here we are on a weekend when we are together and we are contemplating how the cross impacts every facet of life. We talked about how it impacts our freedom. And this weekend, we're going to talk about how it impacts something that's very crucial. And I'm hoping that there are people who will open their eyes, perhaps for the first time, because for the first time in a long time, they've not been contemplating the depth of the soul and the meaning of life. There's just something about crisis that forces us into that kind of predicament. And as we do that, I want to turn our minds to the reality that there is something we need that's even greater than physical health. And your soul knows that. You know, the Bible talks about that we are made up of body and spirit. And your spirit knows that there's something that you need more than physical health, because eventually everyone loses the battle to decay and disintegration of the body. So there has to be something. In order for us to have a peace that passes all understanding in difficult times, there has to be something in us that knows that we are eternal, that there is a disease or a kingdom, rather, that no disease could ever reach, that there's a kingdom that is unshakable. Now, the point is then, what is it about the cross as we move forward in the series that helps us to know there's a bigger need, a greater need than the physical body? And that doesn't mean we don't care about the physical body. We are praying for those who are suffering right now. We pray, we do mourn, but at the same time, we are reminded that we do have a kingdom that is unshakable, and we all want to be part of that kingdom. And if there's a God who truly loves us, then he's going to do whatever he has to open our eyes to the reality of that kingdom and do what is necessary to embrace us so that we may be part of it. And so I want to take us on a little journey, a little trip. And I've said before that tension is the best way to learn truths that have great depth. If I just become an information dispenser, that's not going to create a lot of deep learning. We must go through a journey. We must have tension. And that's what I want to do, is I take you toward the cross, which is the only worldview that will deal with your primary issue, my primary issue, our primary issue, which is guilt. The guilt and the shame that we all encounter through the circumstances of life. In 1960, the Israeli Mossad masterminded one of history's most incredible feats when it tracked down Adolf Eichmann. Eichmann signified terror to millions. He was a major organizer of the Holocaust. He was responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of people, many of whom were children. He was the one responsible for concocting the final solution to the question, what are we to do with the Jews? And his idea was annihilation and genocide. And so the Israeli Mossad in 1960, with the help of Peter Malkin, they were able to track him down living in Argentina in South America, where many of the Jews, or the Gentiles rather, the men and the women who were operating within the Third Reich had escaped somehow to South America. They were very much welcome there. And so they were able to track down Eichmann in his home in Argentina. And Peter Malkin would sit across the road in a borrowed car and watch the movements of Eichmann every day to try to figure out the exact time when they could take him, arrest him with very little publicity, and ultimately take him back to trial. Malkin writes that he watches from across the street day after day, and that Eichmann goes to work at the same time every morning, returns the same time every night at around 6 p.m. And every time he returns home, there's a little blonde-haired, blue-eyed boy, 6 years old, 7 years old, that would greet him, Eichmann's own son. And he would throw his arms up in the air and say, hello, daddy, and there would be this embrace, this love, and this tenderness. Malkin would watch that because many of Malkin's family were killed under Eichmann's regime. In fact, Malkin had lost his own six-year-old nephew. And so he watches and he tries to answer the question, how is it that someone who is so callous and so cavalier toward life and who's responsible for tens of thousands of deaths in the gas ovens, little children, be capable of such emotion to share moments of intimacy with his own six-year-old son? Malkin struggled with this, especially as he looked at the young boy, similar age, similar look, similar sweetness. Well, finally, when the moment was right, with one phrase, un momentito, señor, they caught Eichmann off guard, dragged him into a waiting car, and you know the rest of the story, he was taken to trial and executed. But before the execution, Malkin had a moment with Eichmann. And he said to Eichmann, I just have to know, how is it that someone who's so responsible for the atrocities of the Holocaust, who's responsible for the deaths of so many young children in gas ovens, is capable of showing affection to his own son when you are responsible for the death of my nephew? And Eichmann looked at Malkin and said without delay, well, your nephew was Jewish, wasn't he? Malkin sat there stunned. And he noticed there was absolutely no guilt, no remorse, as if what he had done was perfectly legitimate. And Malkin thought of Eichmann, how is this possible? How is it possible for a human being to commit those kind of atrocities and have no guilt and no shame and no remorse? Now, as you contemplate that, I think it's good to ask a few questions. The first is this, is guilt a good thing? The popular view today is no, it's not a good thing because it robs you of your life. It's attached to subjective ideas that were forced upon you by your community or by your parents or by society to manipulate you to do what they want you to do. So basically, the popular idea is rid yourself of all shame and guilt and you will be happy. My response would be, really? So guilt, as we are told, is just a feeling that we all have that is unattached to any kind of objective morality. You might say yes. Then my next question will be, well, if that's what you believe, then how can you be accusatory to Eichmann? Perhaps his feelings are just different from yours. What makes your feelings any better than his if it's not attached to any objective moral law? Some of you say, no, it is attached to objective morality. Then my next question would be, okay, what is that objective morality? What is the law that we all believe in to which our feelings must conform? And whatever that law is, it must be immutable or unchanging. It must transcend culture and social popularities. And if our feelings get out of whack and they don't conform to an objective morality, then what we end up doing is creating monsters like Eichmann. Adolf Hitler knew this better than anybody else. He said, "I want to raise a generation of young people devoid of a conscience, imperious, relentless, and cruel." He knew the only way he could get an entire generation to commit these atrocities was to remove the idea of guilt and shame, and then he could create a generation of monsters. No one understood that better than him. Remove God, remove guilt, create a whole generation devoid of conscience. Now, why is this important? Because guilt is not a bad thing. It is an intrinsic deterrent to evil. It is a warning device that something is wrong that needs to be repaired. When I was a little boy, my father would take us fishing, and I never got to do the fishing, just my father and my older brother. And my father would give me the designation of finding the worms that they could put on the hook to catch the trout in the free-flowing rivers. For the first couple of years, you know, it took me a long time to find the worms. And then one day I discovered that, man, all you had to do is go over to the riverbed and overturn the rocks. And underneath the rocks, it was like a worm convention. And I could collect enough worms within 3 to 5 minutes. I would take them over to my father. Psychologists today tell us that almost every dis-ease in the human spirit is related to what lies under the rocks of your life. And if you had the courage to pull up those rocks, then you would find little guilt worms everywhere. Look under your anger. What would you find? Look under your bitterness. Look under your anxiety. Look under your inability to take criticism. In fact, psychologists tell us this. They tell us that guilt is the cornerstone of all neurosis. Everything can be tracked back to the underlying issue of guilt, and that guilt is the daily seasoning of life. So the guilt that we experience may be the daily seasoning of life. It may be the stop sign for correction, a detour to stop going this way. But if you don't respond to the guilt in your life appropriately and you shove through or push through the stop signs, then it is a daily dose of disintegration. We know down deep inside that guilt is tied to a moral reality. We know that morality is just as real as nature itself. The feeling of guilt that we have on the inside is just as real as the earth, the wind, and the sky. Now stay with me just a moment here. When I was about 16, probably 15 rather, I had my first real date. And this girl that I was going on my first date with wanted to go to a place called Carowinds. It was a theme park in South Carolina. Thunderous roller coasters. And I have always hated roller coasters. I don't know why you would pay good money to have that sickening feeling. And so we went to a place called Carowinds. They had a famous roller coaster called Thunder Road. And there was no way I was going to tell this girl that I was trying to impress that I was afraid of roller coasters. In fact, I've said before that every courageous thing that men have done has been done to impress a woman somewhere along the line. And so I got on the roller coaster, I rode the roller coaster, and threw up everywhere. And so I don't think I left a good impression. The thing that I hate on those roller coasters is the feeling in your stomach when you drop stories high. And Thunder Road dropped you 15 stories. Not too long ago, we went to Disneyland and I rode the Tower of Terror, the first and only time I will ever ride it. Why you would pay money to have that kind of feeling is beyond me. Now, guilt is the feeling that you get in the pit of your stomach that somehow a ledger is being kept. And when you violate the moral law that you know to be objective, somehow, some way, you're just adding one more point to the negative column. Do you know what the Bible calls that? It calls it eternity. The Bible says that God has placed eternity in the hearts of men, Ecclesiastes, that you know down deep inside that this world, if it has any sense to it at all, has to have some form of justice attached to it. That we all live in a world where one day we will all stand before God and give an account for the way that we've lived our lives. Now, again, you're thinking, why are we talking about this at a difficult time? Well, it reminds me of the story of where four friends lower a paralytic into a room and they're hoping that Jesus will heal him. Instead, Jesus looks to him and says, your sins are forgiven. Now, if you would have been the four friends of the paralytic, you would have said, well, that's all well and good, Jesus. Thanks for that. But what we're really after is a healing. Jesus is trying to show us that we're all worried about the physical, but there is a deeper issue, and it's the spiritual that impacts the outside. And so since we're all worried about what's going on in the world with an illness, I hope that we will see that when this illness is stopped, when it is stopped in its tracks, when we go back to some normality of life, I am hoping and praying that we will have the same desire to look on the inside and know there's something more, far more serious in our lives that have to be dealt with. And so somebody comes to me and they'll say, Pastor Jeff, I hear what you're saying about guilt, but if God is so good, why can't God just forgive us? Yes, I'm a sinner. I've done bad things. We all have. But come on, God just needs to chill. Why can't he just say, you're forgiven? Somebody will complain and say, you know, God is so powerful. He never has to wait for things. He can just speak something into existence. Let there be light. And light was. God doesn't say, before I create light, what do I need from the electrical store? No, he's so powerful that when he speaks something, it becomes a reality. Immediately, instantly, intention brings reality. Let there be sea, and there was sea. Let there be land, sky, and animals, and land, sky, and animals. Now, let me just pause just for a moment. Just around your circles of community here in fellowship, have you ever wondered what you would do with that kind of power? What would you do if you could just speak a word and it was true? I've made a list of some of the things I would do. First, let all cell phones be silent during the movie. By now, you know that I have a real problem with that. It'd be great to just speak it and all cell phones no longer work at the movie theater and I can actually enjoy the film. Or how about this one? Let all LA drivers learn how to merge. Wouldn't that be cool if we could just speak it and it happens? Or how about let those who talk loudly on their cell phones in public places be inflicted with the fleas of 1,000 camels? That would be great. Or let all those who play videos on their cell phones at full volume without headphones on the airplane before takeoff be kicked off the plane. That would be good. And then, of course, let all those who do not understand any of the comments I just made, because they're the ones committing these wretched sins, move to San Francisco and become Giants fans. They should fit right in. Seriously, though, let there be sea, and sea is. Let there be land and sky and sky and animals exist. So why can't God say, let there be forgiveness, and forgiveness is? And the answer is the cross. Because on the cross, we are told something very crucial about the character and nature of God. Let me read it again. It's in Romans 3, verse 25 through 26. We are told this. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies. God's very nature is not only love and forgiveness, where he can say you're forgiven, but it's also justice. We said a few weeks ago that if a judge said to a perpetrator who had raped a young woman, that's okay, as long as you're sorry, you can go free, we would call that an atrocity. We expect justice to be upheld. And God is both just and the one who justifies. So when he sends his own son to die on the cross, justice is upheld because sin is paid for, but his love moves in to pay the debt that you and I owe. Now, this is where the Christian worldview is different than any other worldview or philosophy. The question is, how does God deal with our violation of his objective law that is tied to our guilt? There's a reason that we feel guilt. There's a reason that we feel shame. Because when God gives his law, he does so in a way that is supposed to promote love and peace. If we live within these parameters and confines, then there will be peace and there will be harmony and there will be goodwill toward men. We get outside of these parameters, then our society begins to wreak havoc on one another. So because we are all guilty of violating the law and therefore experience guilt and shame, how does God deal with it? And in Romans 3:25, we're told that God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement. He deals with it through the principle of self-substitution. This is the heart of the gospel. This is why Christianity is fundamentally different to every other religious system. John Stott, one of the greatest thinkers, said that as the essence of sin is us substituting ourselves for God, the essence of salvation is God substituting himself for us. At the core of all sin is our inability or unwillingness to allow God to be God and instead attempting to usurp the power and authority of God. We all do it. I do it. You do it. We think about it. We are society. We want to determine our own morality. We don't want an objective morality where some God somewhere is telling us how to live. That's taking over the throne of God. We live like an owner rather than a tenant. We think that everything we have is ours, belongs to us and us alone. We don't see it as a gift from God. We live lives of egocentrism. We think the world evolves around us and what we want and our needs, rather around God and his calling on our life to be the people on planet Earth that would bring peace and love and joy by self-sacrifice and generosity. All of us, I do, you do, we fight the temptation to be in control. Submission is difficult for all of us. And that in itself is the foundation for all sin. Think about it. We even come up with our own religion. And we have talked about this often. It's the gospel of morality. It's the chart that we've used so many times before. Most people come up with their own way whereby they believe they are at peace with God if God doesn't indeed exist. And their own gospel of morality is this. Well, as long as I have more good, as long as I can write my name above the 50% mark of goodness, then I'll be accepted before God. The only problem is, where is your objective truth that supplies this kind of subjective feeling? Who told you that's the way that you had to communicate or relate to God? Because the Bible teaches that God is 100% holy and pure and righteous. And if this is the way you choose to relate to him, which would be a bad call on your part, but if that's the way you choose to relate to God by law, then you would have to be 100% good, and no one is. So is the essence of sin is us substituting ourselves for God, so the essence of salvation is God substituting himself for us. So because we put ourselves where only God deserves to be, he put himself where only we deserve to be. So in Christ, God came and took what we deserved. So it's still the law of moral accounting. He paid, he suffered. You owed, I owed, but he paid. That's called self-substitution, and there's nothing else like it in humanity. There is no more profound and dramatic and intense principle than the concept of self-substitution. And if you think about our society, anytime you hear a story that has this kind of dramatic storyline that's compelling, that's heart-melting, any story that we tell of this ilk, it's the ultimate drama.
You've been listening to Today with Jeff Vines. Thanks for joining us. Next time, we'll bring you the rest of this message from Pastor Jeff.
He's the only person in history who chose the fact of death, motivated by his love for us. And because we put ourselves where Jesus deserves to be, at the forefront of our lives, he put himself where we deserve to be, separated from God for a moment, that we could be with God for eternity.
You can listen to more messages like this. Just search for Today with Jeff Vines wherever you get your podcasts. You make me want to dance and sing with every single breath I breathe. I will break this offering. You are my wonder. You make the wonder.
Today.
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 Today with Jeff Vines.
Thanks for taking time to listen to this audio on demand from Vision Christian Media. To find out more about us, go to vision.org.au.